thanks. Well, I'm going to fly through some slides then on this topic. This is a sort of a bringing you up to date on some of the latest work in a series of papers we've been working on modeling disks self-consistently from the collapse of molecular cloud cores, so going down from a tenth of a parsec scale down to several AU is how well we can do it. And so very quick review from a previous talk, you know, the kind of different approaches that people are doing in the community now. You can, of course, deal with your semi-analytic alpha viscous models, but I think we're at the stage where we're looking for real physical transport mechanisms. And so you can model that, you know, ideally in three dimensions using either a periodic shearing box approximation or, better yet, a global simulation. The issue is, if you're trying to do the full problem, you can only study a limited dynamic range of either spatial or temporal scales. You may be able to do a great deal of spatial scales, but it's very hard to, once you've formed a protostar in a very short time scale in the vicinity, to then keep integrating another million years when your inner time scale is extremely short in comparison. So we have adopted a thin disk approximation approach, which allows us to go further in time, but also allows us to do this self-consistent approach with a large number of spatial scales and form the disk from the collapse of a molecular cloud core. So some of the advantages that I've already mentioned is that we can form a protostar, which is, you know, in an approximate way, modeling it with a sink cell. But then we can go on and study the next million years or several million years of evolution. Whereas typically with 3D, you're stuck at around 1,000 years or so after the protostar forms. So that's one of our big advantages at the moment with this approach, as well as the fact that we can do the large number of spatial scales. And of course, once you get your model to run, it might only take you days or at most a couple of weeks. So you can run a very large number of models and compile your statistics and do your parameter study. So in principle, this study itself is a continuation of a different class of work on molecular cloud fragmentation. And we know these cores are non-axis symmetric. And you can take a mildly non-axis symmetric initial state, that or that, and zoom in with a non-uniform grid and follow the collapse to late stages. And so these are not isolated disks when they form. So now, for full disclosure here, and this is actually an important part of the story, to tell you what's in this model and what's not. We're studying essentially either hydrodynamic, or you could say, in some cases, you can put in a supercritical flux-frozen magnetic field, but what we don't have is magnetic breaking. In fact, Zeeun will give an interesting talk tomorrow on that effect, and that can certainly change the outcome tremendously. On the other hand, if you have magnetic dissipation, that will then bring us back toward the limit that I'm talking about. In the innermost region, you cannot actually drag in all that magnetic flux, as many of you know and have written papers about, and so you are getting back to this weak field limit. We have a sink cell within the inner 5AU. You can't really do magnetorotational instability, but how important is that? Maybe we can have a discussion of that towards the end. We're using a barotropic equation of state for estimating the temperatures. Okay, this is again going to be really quick. Essentially, we're using the initial profiles that almost everybody gets in this kind of business, that is r to the minus 1 scaling at large radii of surface density, angular velocity, and poloidal magnetic field, if you have it. The numbers here, I'm not going to emphasize, we can come back to this later, but essentially we're talking about outer scales of 10,000 AU. This is just a characteristic turnover where you go from a flat profile to a power law. Typical initial rotation rates of about a kilometer per second per parsec. You can essentially take alpha to be zero, so consider this all to be non-magnetic models. I think that they are actually non-magnetic in the ones I'm showing. One of the basic results is that if you form this protostar, the central sink, the accretion onto that central object initially has a peak due to large velocities generated in the prestellar flow. Then you settle down to some rate that is some factor multiplied by the sound speed cubed over gravitational constant, if your core is large enough. And you're settling in there, so that's the classic story we all know. And then, as you also know, when you form a disk, something dramatic has to happen. As you get to those mass shells, which are centrifugally balanced, the accretion rate drops by over an order of magnitude, and it stays low until you get severe gravitational instability in the disk, and that's what drives the accretion up in these brief bursts. And you can see they're beautifully correlated with the Toomey Q parameter, averaged over the centrifugal disk. The Toomey parameter is, of course, irrelevant before this stage. Once you've formed the disk, it's getting dragged down lower and lower as mass accumulates in the disk, below some fiducial critical value, which is of order 1, and then you get the burst. And as the burst happens, Q gets raised up again because you've emptied the disk of a significant portion of mass, because the burst is an inflow of a large amount of matter into the center. And then you're again cycling down in Q, and every now and then, when it falls below or comes close to the critical value, you get a burst again and it goes back up. So you get these cycles going on, and notice that that's going up to 500,000 years. On the time.
So how much of the mass is in the smooth phase and how much in the burst phase?
Once the burst starts, most of it's in the bursts.
Right, actually. How much of the mass, of the total stellar mass, how much is added in the bursting phase?
Okay, it depends on how much rotation you have in your core, okay? So where the onset is definitely depends on the amount of angular momentum in the disk, okay? In this case, quite a bit of accretion has actually happened before you get the disk. But then again, the disk, in this case, forms when the centrifugal barrier hits about 5 or 10 AU, where our central sink is. In reality, it forms much earlier. So it probably formed earlier if you could model it further in. So my intuition is it would start relatively early, and then you would, once they start, most of the mass accumulation occurs during those burst phases. Okay? It's more than 50%. In fact, probably about 90%. Okay, so there's the dichotomy of the time that you're about to get a big amount of mass flowing into the center, which is that's a photograph, a picture image of the disk just before you're getting a burst. And what you see is you've got dense clumps that have formed by the nonlinear fragmentation of spiral arms. These clumps are then torqued in rapidly through their interaction with the trailing spiral arm, and they fall in, and you get the big blip in the mass accretion rate and luminosity. But most of the time, the disk looks like this. It's got a very flocculent, weak spiral structure. That is the more natural state of the disk. The black region is, of course, not empty. This is just the color table. Our simulation region would be at least 100 times larger than this image. All right, so again, coming back to our accretion model, this is, notice now, 3 million years. So you can get well beyond the initial bursty phase, and it's a beautiful correlation of that phase with the accretion from the envelope onto the disk. This is exactly what Kenyon et al. Suggested empirically originally, that you would have bursts occurring while the envelope was feeding the disk at a high rate, essentially a greater rate than the disk could normally feed the central star. So Lee Hartman made this sketch many years ago of, intuitively what he thought was going on based on the observations of FU Ori objects. And here a dashed line is the envelope accretion. And it's almost eerie. We're getting, through a self-consistent calculation, something quite similar. And perhaps most interestingly, which is the focus of my talk today, is really this phase, where I'll point out the accretion rate is sort of where you want it for T Tauri stars. Yes? So
do you have an accretion shock around the disk?
Yes, there is.
From a disk?
The disk boundary is, well, again, depends on how much angular momentum you start with, but it's several tens of astronomical units. Okay, so this is what I really want to talk about today. Even at late times, you're driving accretion 10 to the minus 8 or so solar masses per year. What is the mechanism that's driving that accretion?
Okay, before you go on, so you're not going to talk about whether this model that Hartman and Kenyon have actually worked to explain. Because, you know, there's a big puzzle about the fact that the average luminosity of quasars is too low.
Right.
And there are not that many F. Tauri sources seen.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not, it seems to me that when the observers actually tried to come up, they never were able to explain the total amount of energy that should have been radiated.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good question. I'm not aware of an actual numerical estimate. I guess the stats are, based on the observations of F. Tauri, that each star would undergo 10 to 20 bursts in its lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're underluminous by a factor of 10.
Well, F. Tauri is fine, it's just they're very pure.
Yeah, right. But I think... But there's still enough that the statistics are every star would have undergone multiple bursts, right? 10 to 20 or so.
But I think when they tried to say that to release the total amount of energy needed to release my understanding of this, so
mm-hmm. It still falls short.
Anyway, okay.
All right. Yeah. So. Good point. All right. So I want to show you some profiles of what's happening in the disk. One set is at a relatively early time, 0.2 million years, but I'm going to focus more on the later times. So these are angle averaged profiles of angular velocity, surface density, temperature, and the Q parameter. And which is the most interesting one? Well, okay, where do I start? The disk is never that massive. It's always significantly less massive than the star. There's never an early time when the disk mass is very large compared to the stellar mass. So there's some efficient torques transporting material from the beginning. Even at 0.2 megayears, we have essentially a Keplerian angular velocity within the disk, and you can tell very well where the disk boundary is.
Can you define significantly less massive? Is it less than a tenth of the mass of the central star? It's a hundredth of the mass?
Yes, good point. It's always, you know, it's never more than 25% in any model. Okay, and by these stages, it's 10% or even a bit less.
Right. Now, have you tried varying your barotropic equation to state these? It seems like if you had a warmer disk, you might be able to support more mass in the disk before you hit Q equals 1.
Mm-hmm. We've tried we have tried various barotropic equation states and gone even higher temperatures than people would normally believe exist in the disk. And you're essentially going to force the disk to go through those bursts no matter what. You'll get them happening less often in the early phase.
Well, I'm just wondering about the disk to star mass ratio, because the reason I'm interested in this is in my radius simulations,
right.
I get up to 50%.
Okay.
So I'm curious what the difference could be.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll address that a bit in the next few slides, and we can talk about that more. So we're Keplerian, r to the minus 1.5. The temperature is weakly non-isothermal. I mean, these are log-log plots, and this is linear log. So there is non-isothermality. Of course, it's within the context of our barotropic equation of state. You're talking several tens of Kelvin. The Q parameter is self-regulated at the critical value. So essentially, the disk cannot become highly unstable, because if it does, well, you've seen what happens. You dump more matter into the center. And at late stages, the disk is less massive than it was before, but it's still able to self-regulate. So that means there's still persistent non-axisymmetric structure in this disk, even when it's not very massive. And I think this is the key result here, that you can have fluctuations that persist up to 1.5 million years, for example. You can see the Q value has risen slightly from here to here, and the fluctuations are decreasing in time, but there's still enough to be driving this low-level accretion. The self-regulation essentially is driving accretion into the center at some rate, 10 to the minus 8 solar masses, maybe a little bit less at this time. And if you can maintain that, and you're doing it through the non-axisymmetric structure, Q is essentially constant. The temperature has a weak variation. Then this ratio is going to be unity, roughly. That's essentially Keplerian, so that's r to the minus 1.5. Kappa and omega scale the same for Keplerian rotation. So sigma is also r to the minus 1.5. So it's a deceptively simple argument to explain what you get, the slope. If you grind up all the planets and spread out the mass and add hydrogen and helium, you get that same slope of the minimum mass solar nebula. So it's, again, it's a deceptively simple argument, and I'd like to believe it has to be the case, because it really, without having various magnetic effects even, much as I like magnetic fields, this gives us a baseline result that gets this beautiful result dropping out. Now that's an axisymmetric profile, it's an angle average profile, but it only can arise due to the non-axisymmetry in the disk. You could never get it in an axisymmetric idealized calculation. Okay, but now the big question, can this have anything to do with reality? The standard objection to gravitationally driven evolution has always been the masses. The masses would need to be too high. This is based on various simulations, Laughlin-Bodenheimer, for example, that the distance-star mass ratio needs to be roughly 0.1 in order for gravitational instabilities to be significant. Now, 0.1 is not a very large number. I mean, that shows you gravity is still very efficient. You can get 90% of the job done of transporting matter into the center, perhaps, through gravity. That's the implication here. And indeed, that's what we find. We find that this mass is always of order 10% or less of the central star due to gravitational torques alone. At the end of our simulation, maybe it's even a little bit less than 10%. And we're still driving this T-Torre-type accretion. But you know, the objection still is, well, observations are down at 1%. And here's a figure from Scholes et al. Of star mass down here, and the ratio of the disk to star mass. And for a large number of these objects, you're sitting at about 0.01 or even below, by a little bit. Andrews and Williams claim the average is about 0.005.
And what age are those sources?
I think they're pegged at about between a half and a couple million years.
They've all cleared their envelopes, right? And this is all non-embedded stuff that you can do with Spitzer, right, where you can see that they are disk.
Yeah. So these are relatively late times. Essentially, I think that's a fair statement for them all.
Right. I'm just wondering whether the difference between the data and your model is that it has a lot of later, older stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which
mm-hmm.
would probably be smaller too.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Nevertheless, to get down to that level, even I would say it's not clear that the gravitational torques could keep working and get you all the way there. So there's certainly room for other effects. If those numbers are right. But I want to maybe have a discussion about this, have this lead to a discussion as to how solidly convinced are we that that's what we should be trying to fit. Once you have a number like 0.01, you stick with it. You know, it's either 0.01 or it's 0.1, right? We talk in factors of 10. But here's the other, some of the counter arguments perhaps that we might want to think about the fact that disks might be more massive. Well, this I'll point out, nice paper by Larson in the early 80s, which sort of made some analytic arguments that seem to be consistent with the model I showed you, that you only need small persistent fluctuations in a disk that are non-axisymmetric, of course, to drive torques that give you 10 to the minus 8 or so solar masses per year of accretion. But you all know these two cases of Herbig AE/BE star disks, which have significant spiral structure, and the implication there is that gravitational effects are important. Furthermore, did I screw up the slide somehow? Okay, I screwed it up. Oh, okay, there we go. This is a nice point that Lee Hartman had made at a conference we had at Western last year, which is that we should be very careful with those disk masses in that they're based on various number of assumptions, the main one being that the grains are not their standard interstellar values. If they were, the disk masses would be estimated to be much, much larger than they are, much larger than I'm claiming that they could be. So you typically, you assume this grain growth in the disks, and log A max of about 3 is about 1 millimeter. That's typically the size taken. And at that, the interesting thing is, at that size, you have a peak in the opacity. And if the grains were smaller, or perhaps more likely even larger, if there had been more grain growth, the opacity would be lower. And lower opacities yield larger masses. So this is a point to really keep in mind, that there really are big uncertainties in the disk mass estimates. And we're only talking of factors of not even 10, really, that we need to go from this completely no gravity regime to gravitationally driven regime.
Do we have any mass estimates based on gas rather than dust?
Not that I know of, but someone else may. That's
gas
one.
Measurements are, they're increasing gas measurements, but they tend to be on the outer layers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They don't penetrate to where most masses. It's a very difficult problem, but there are a lot of people working on it.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the issue of the molecular completion. So whether you're sure, when you look at a molecule, how compatible is it?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something whose uncertainties are orthogonal to the dust uncertainties. So.
Okay. This.
I think the dust masses. Are not hugely uncertain. There's this beta factor about their millimeter, the slope of the millimeter. There's a couple of things, but they're not thought to be deeply uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
The dust masses, I don't think. Because in the millimeter, it's transparent. There's no optical width.
But you're saying that if the grains were larger, like if they were centimeters instead of a millimeter, then according to that graph, and how do you know whether it's a millimeter or a centimeter?
Okay, some other constraints. I'm just going to bring up a bunch. I'm not saying these are all the correct arguments, but these are things to think about. These are all points that the various people have made in the literature. If you look at the mass accretion rate for various objects with disks, then certainly at the upper end of the accretion rates that are measured, if you assume these disks are around for even 1 million years, you're talking about a tenth of a solar mass in the disk that's accreted. And that is most likely to be a lower limit because, A, not all the mass in the disk will get accreted. And secondly, that's just using exactly 1 million years, and the age may be somewhat larger. On the other hand, you can say, but wait a minute, what about all these other data points? Leave aside the brown dwarfs. Talk about T Tauri stars, which have accretion rates more like 10 to the minus 8. Well, yes, then in 1 million years, you would have 1/100th of a solar mass. But again, keep in mind, we're not trying to necessarily raise this even to 0.1, but at least, say, to 0.05. And there's various other constraints. So the accretion rate itself is uncertain. And there's been a suggestion that it's not only uncertain, but it may have been systematically underestimated. And again, we have a case where estimates may need to be pushed up higher than what they are. Okay, exosolar planets. The minimum mass solar nebula, as we normally calculate it, and you truncate it about 50 astronomical units or so, and you have a certain value of the density in a power law, it's 0.01 solar masses. And so that's consistent with the millimeter data, I guess. But that's barely enough to make Jupiter. So again, you don't have much extra mass to play with, even in our solar system. And let alone that then cannot explain the exosolar planets, which are much more massive than Jupiter. So at least in those cases, one would have to concede that the disk would be significantly larger in mass than 0.01 solar masses. The final constraints, I'll say, well, the first one regarding our own nebula, well, what I just told you is that we can at least fit, sorry, that should be a -3/2. We can fit that that profile with our self-regulated disk, but what's the actual density? The mass would depend on what the actual value was, and also perhaps where you truncate the disk. There's some work from the meteoritic community, as well as astronomers who have been modeling chondral formation, and basically the constraints, as I understand it, seem to require a large density in the disk. And Desch and Connolly suggest it can be up to 10 times the standard density of the MMSN. And Voss and Durison have suggested that the chondrules are formed in these spiral density wave shocks, and that also requires a more massive disk than the MMSN. So it's another independent argument, again arguing for more massive disks than generally are believed. Okay, so I'd like to maybe see what you think about that and have a discussion on it. But my point is that basically it's surprising. It was a surprise to me, actually, as to how well the gravitational torques worked at transporting matter. I think there are other effects. But this seems to account for the largest portion of what you need, of accretion that you need. The disk masses are really not that large, even in this model. And I think this is a beautiful explanation for the MMSN slope. And even with the data that we have, we're probably looking at a model that can do well with the Herbig AED stars. Or more massive objects. And for the lower mass stuff, maybe other mechanisms at play, but it sure would be nice to have a universal model that applied across the whole spectrum. And of course, it's not that bad at low masses because it's the disk to star mass ratio that's important, and lower mass objects will have lower mass disks, but the ratio can be high. And so this is, I think, something where it'll be interesting to see if there's any movement in the next few years and observers start scaling up their mass estimate. Okay, that's it.
So if Q is constant, to get this sigma proportion to that, you need the sound speed to be behaving, or temperature to be behaving a certain way. I didn't catch what exactly is
that. It just has to behave weak, it has a weak dependence, that's all. Because the surface density and angular velocity are parallels. And the temperature is just varying from 10 to 50 or Kelvin or so. So as long as this quantity is not varying much, then that ratio would be uniform.
Okay.
if the disk is self-regulating, so tomb rake parameter can never drop below.
Of course, once you transfer into the picture, you'll get more heating than that. So that's going to be a larger variation.
It can give you larger temperatures, yeah, no doubt. If you look at the stellar radiation models, they're talking of somewhat higher temperatures in the inner region, but not a lot higher. You know, you're talking maybe 10 degrees higher than we have at these distances.
We've had temperatures go up to a few hundred degrees.
Well, but we've got, I mean, these are one solar mass stars.
Yeah, for massive stars and massive. Yeah.
Well, and we've got more massive stars, and we've got higher accretion rates because, so I think that may be even our models, that you're looking at, you know, your peak accretion rate, you know, your feeding rate peaks out at, you know, C thermal cubed over G, where C thermal is computed for 10 Kelvin gas.
Right.
Whereas for massive stars, it certainly has to be higher.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that may be why we get warmer and more massive disks.
Right, right.
Is because,
right.
You know, even before we get nuclear burning, just a higher accretion rate gives you more radiative heating.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you'd have a hotter, more massive disk, and I think you'd also get a self-regulation, right?
Yeah, we do. We self-regulate to Q equals 1, 2. It's just our disk parameters are somewhat different at self-regulation.
Right, right, right. Okay. Yeah, Eric?
So why do you have a sharp outer edge, less than 180?
It forms that way, okay? It's maybe not a very good answer, but you do have matter falling in from the envelope, and that is a Ram pressure coming in. So at early times, there's quite a bit of matter falling in. At later times, that infall has dropped a lot, but you're still maintaining the edge. It is moving out, you can see, from here to here to here, but this is not an alpha viscous, it's not a viscous disk. If you put in alpha viscosity, this thing would spread out in no time. But in this case, you don't have the mechanism to spread it that fast, particularly in the outer layers.
Well, I have two comments. One against it, one for it. Hubble has imaged some disks which are several hundred AU.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. That's something that suggests it's not always true. However, our disk, Hubble has also determined that the Kuiper belt was truncated at 40 AU, rather sharply.
Right.
And that is usually attributed to that something dramatic has to truncate it, and it's thought to be photo evaporation. For most stars, it's just a common idea. Nobody knows. But if you can get that truncation more naturally, sort of in isolation, that's an interesting point that could be talked about with respect to the type of evaporation.
Okay, thanks. I'll keep that in mind. The 100 AU disk is an interesting point because, yeah, that's probably an evolved disk, right?
I think they're evolved disks.
Yeah.
Anything you can image with HST.
Yeah, right.
Some of them have HH probes, and you see them by reflection.
Right.
And some of them are probably.
Yeah, the size of the disk is quite a sensitive quite sensitive to the amount of angular momentum that your initial collapsing cloud has. So I wouldn't claim that this is a unique number by any means. Thanks, Chris.
So Paolo over here, he, as you know, has a different theory. And the main observation that he relied on is that the accretion rate appears to scale as the square of the mass of the star. And so he said, well, that you would naturally get from just, von D. Euler accretion.
Mm-hmm.
So in your model, do you get that m dot, whereas I would think that you basically have, since the mass of the disk is proportional to the star, and it's always a couple of million years, you're going to, on average, get m dot going like m.
We can get something like this. In fact, we're working on that. That's the current paper. it does depend on your initial conditions, I hate to say it, but I think it's a more satisfying explanation than von D. Euler accretion. We do expect the angular momentum to vary with the initial core size and even the ratio of angular momentum to mass. And there is a trend that it goes up, and it goes up more steeply than just one.
And why is that? I gave you the argument that you're saying that m disk over m star is about.
M disk over m star is not constant in this scenario. It's a weakly increasing as you go to larger masses.
But it has to go like m in order to get m squared.
And we don't get m squared.
Okay.
We don't get m squared, but we get more than m.
Okay.
We're somewhere in between.
Yeah.
One can fiddle around with the initial conditions and see if one can get m squared.
Are the data, I mean, of course, Paolo fastened on the fact that it's consistent with m squared. Mm-hmm. In fact, as you were criticizing some of the data before, is it possible that the data are consistent with a weaker dependence on two?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, at the Chamonix meeting, there was some further data points here which seem to drag the slope down. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how you get a slope from these data?
Get your least squares fitter out. That is not the best fit, by the way. This is Lee Hartman's, that's his, I didn't explain what this was. This was his line of M disk accreted over M star being 0.1 at all masses, okay, for any mass. That's where you'd have to be for the accreted mass to be a tenth of the stellar mass. So this is probably what your least squares fit would give you, and that's roughly 2.
But isn't that biased by the fact that it's hard to measure a low M dot on a high mass star?
That's right. There could be a lot of objects here that are not detected. Okay.
So again,
the only argument there is to really believe it is that you don't see many objects here. Okay. In fact, this wasn't even known until the brown dwarf data came along. Okay. Till that, it was a scatter plot. If you just look at these. Once the brown dwarf data came along, okay, there's a beautiful correlation. But yes, you're not observing that. So this is the heart of the argument. Why do you not see the high accreting brown dwarfs?
But if you're at an age, if you're at an age of a million years, you can't have a tenth of a solar mass star if you're accreting an m dot of 10 to the minus 7. There's a violation, there's a conservation of mass law that cuts off the top of the plot.
Well, I agree. I mean, you probably couldn't have such initial conditions that would give you that.
That's M dot going like M. That's what the condition you just did.
I'm just saying there's just a sanity check.
Exactly.
Right?
But then I'm saying, why is it M squared? Although in the previous, I don't know what Paolo did. You're pointing there are not as many points in that upper part of the ground world, but there are a lot. And so if you did a least squares fit, it wouldn't be M squared.
One should keep in mind about
Why don't you do least squares fits in these data?
Observers fits.
First and only thing to.
According to the lower right, have been found. There's some 10 million. There's a time effect here too. So there's some 10 million-year-old stars, which have, with great difficulty, been found to have what I call a dribble accretion. At 10 to the minus 10 to 10 to the minus 11. And those are roughly half a solar mass or a solar mass. So they fill in, not densely, there's only a few known. There's half a dozen known points that have been, we chose not to plot, that are older, that are in the empty region of the lower right. Mm-hmm. And so stars at a given mass will move downward with mm-hmm. age until right. it goes to zero.
Well, that suggests there's not body oil accretion, because why would that go down?
It's all
because
you move out of
the.
Yeah,
it's disk accretion.
It's known to be disk accretion.
It's disk accretion.
No
yeah.
Oil,
it's not, yeah. I mean.
Body oil comes into the disk and then it goes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At 10 million years, there's nothing, and these things are in the empty galaxy.
There's even,
Even at 1 million years, I would say mm-hmm. envelope accretion is negligible, right? So only in the protostellar phases, of 5 years,
right.
Spherical aspect of it. It's
very
this,
true.
This
yeah.
curve is thought to be, these data sets are thought to be almost entirely due to disk accretion.
So I guess what I'm trying to understand is, why wouldn't you be more concerned about what causes a factor of 100 dynamic range at m dot at a given mass at the same age? Isn't that?
They're not the same age.
So this is just a really bad plot.
Yeah, it's the only data you have. Right. They're absolutely true. There could be time, this dot could become that dot at a later time. Although some people have argued that the spread is larger than would be possible given the estimated age spread. Okay. So then the argument is different initial conditions. You have one isochrone here, another one there, another one there. You're always going to be very sensitive, from our experience, to the amount of angular momentum you have. It makes a huge difference for a disk.
That's just
going to
be with dispersion, and that doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, within a given law, you know, but you have to also know how the angular momentum scales with the mass, for example, in initial state. For example,
yeah,
is...
You left out the magnetic breaking, so it's hard to...
Right, yeah, yeah. The magnetic breaking will change it a lot. I would suggest, though, that in the innermost region, you get back toward this because the field dissipates out. Yes.
I don't remember. What's the observed spread of the beta parameter in the rotation of the cores? Is there a large spread, or do they all fall next to each other? So there's no huge variation in such condition.
There's a moderate spread of the angular velocity. It's, you know, from half a kilometer per second to maybe 4 kilometers per second. But that makes a huge difference in beta, okay? Because it's the square of that. And beta affects the disk size quite sensitively, because if you just wrote down your centrifugal radius, it's j squared. So small differences in angular velocity even do lead to large differences in the outcome.
Question.
If it's angular momentum conservation the whole way through.
Can I ask a single question about your surface density? If you take normal disks and you give them the sharp edges, they become unstable because it's the edge mode effect. Are you sure you haven't just done that here?
Well, we have transport going on throughout the disk, so I'm not familiar with
this. For some reason, you have a very sharp edge, which I can't understand why it's there. But if you did that, your disk would go unstable due to edge marks. This is a
So would that lead to accretion?
Well, it will lead to not actually symmetric instabilities, but they wouldn't really be there if the disk didn't have such a sharp edge.
Well, I think the edge is natural, though. I mean,
no, I don't think it's natural. It doesn't look natural.
I think it is. you're going from essentially free fall at some point to centrifugal support. And so there's going to be a discontinuity there. And over time, when the accretion has died away, yes, I agree, it will spread out.
I guess other people have similar results. Do you have sharp edges?
Well, it's hard to. It's hard to say. What depends on what you mean by edge. There's no. There does seem to be a fairly sharp fall off in column density, but that's because our disks are being fed by these big filaments. And so what's really going on is that you've got a filament that's shearing out into a disk.
That's a much more complicated.
Okay, but if I were right, and you soften the edge here, I suspect your non-axis symmetric modes would go away. So.
Well, I think the edge does have a lot to do with the fact that the fluctuations are sticking around. You've got reflections off the edge.
Well, that's what happens. And that drives the unstable modes. So what I would like you to do, I'm sure you won't, but what I would like you to do is make that edge not so sharp. There are various papers with Trimmery and others in Selwood about how sharp that has to be in order to drive these edge modes.
Well,
if
I will
softened it, if you softened it and they went away, then you would know that at least that was driving it. Then we could
I don't want to soften it artificially, though, right?
It's all artificial. This is simulation.
Well, we could all go home.
Maybe a way of addressing that would be to put in some small amount of viscosity, since you can't really do it
on.
Alpha is 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3 or something.
Right.
And that will naturally soften your edge.
Yeah, we've been actually playing around with that. And if you put in a constant alpha, this will smooth out very fast.
But
I don't believe it. I don't believe that's true. I don't think alpha is constant.
Then is, what do your non-axisymmetric modes go away when you do that?
Oh no, this is a toy model. This is an axisymmetric model where we're putting in alpha. So we then don't have this. Okay. I could do that. I could do that. But you have to convince me it's worth doing because we can add an alpha term in the non-axisymmetric solution. But look at this, for example. That's not an arbitrary density profile. That's r to the minus a half. That is the self-similar free-fall solution for a disk. So this is the right solution of matter falling in. We have that correctly. And this, we understand, there has to be a transition. Now, would it be a little bit different if we did things a bit differently? Sure, it could be. But I believe there is a transition there.
Terry said yesterday, Hubble was useless, then quoted Hubble this morning saying you can observe this to, you don't see such changes. So I wish to emphasize the point that Hubble, one, is not useless. And two, these sharp edges don't seem to be there in the situations where you can observe them.
Okay, that was not much later.
Well, then.
All right, I'm trying out.
Okay, why don't we thank Chantal. So we're now going to move out of the very